Good morning. I want to talk to you today about 1 Timothy chapter 6 on the subject of wealth. So you can turn there, and I have one slide too, which I'm going to put up early. Thank you. And I also want to tell you that I recognize it's warm, and so we will try and be alert here, move through these things. I don't want to miss what God's saying, but I don't want us to languish either after a certain amount of time. It's hard to focus. This subject of wealth is something I've thought a lot about. When I've spoken in the past on the subject, it's largely been from 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, or the other place in the New Testament that has a prominent discussion of wealth is what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. Particularly those verses where he says you cannot serve God and mammon. There's a whole little section there in the Sermon on the Mount. Although the scripture as a whole, Old Testament especially, is just replete with discussions of this subject. And it's because it's to help us to learn. God gives us physical things in this world, possessions, to understand spiritual things. As I was going through this passage in 1 Timothy 6, there's another major area in the New Testament that talks about wealth. There's a verse in here which we'll read that it says, encourage the rich to be generous in good works. And I've been thinking about that. And as I went through the passage, I've been looking at it for a bit, I found it a little hard to figure out how to approach it. And then this came to mind. And I want to explain what this means. And then as we go through the passage, I'll refer to this. It doesn't explain everything in the passage, but it's given me places to kind of help shape what's in the passage. I want to take a quick sidestep here on understanding the Bible, or understanding anything, the way our minds are created. As we mature, we come to learn certain things. We get to be fairly good at understanding certain things. Hopefully, that's true in our job. If we become very mature as parents or husband and wife, it would be true of those relationships. And could be good in another skill we have that's not job-related. Maybe we're good gardeners or good cooks. We're so good that we make a living cooking. Some people can do that, and that's wonderful. But when we get good at certain things, it forms a picture of knowledge in our minds. Other things that we learn, we tend to associate with them. In other words, we hang new thoughts on old thoughts. That's a learning process. So one of the reasons it's good to have little structures like this, when we look at the Bible, is to have places in the scripture which we're more familiar with, because they're most relevant to our lives, or because they're the most fundamental teaching in the scriptures. And when we get to those passages to say, now, I've read this, and I have some understanding of it, and I'm trying to walk in it, how do I understand it and explain it to someone else, or re-explain it to myself? If we can do that for certain parts of the Bible, many other parts would be much easier for us to understand. So I just want to encourage us, when we come to key subjects in the Bible, take your time and say, what have you taught me about this? What are the key things, and how do I put them in my head? And some of us like to study and others don't. But each of us will have a life story based on what God is teaching us. That's what we're responsible for, not necessarily to be a teacher, but to be able to say, you know, here's what God has taught me, and here's how it's helping me. And then we will relate other things to that. Anyway, wealth and riches needs to be on our list of things that we have some understanding of. So let me explain this little thing. What I want to do is give you some definitions on here. And then there'll be some other terms that come up that we'll discuss in the passage. Yeah. And these are what I call working definitions. In other words, these are ways of looking at a term that are kind of immediately or relatively immediately applicable in our lives. Let me give you an example from a word that's not up there. example, the word love. Now, people have thought about love, books have been written on it, and there are many profound thoughts about what love really is. How would you say what that is? Those are the kind of philosophical and theological thoughts of love. But when I am asking myself a simple question, am I loving my friend? Am I loving my child? Those abstract definitions are less helpful. But practical kind of definition or element of love is that which seeks the best possible good for its object. It's a very, very useful, what I call functional or practical definition, because if I'm asking myself, am I loving my friend, I can ask myself the question, well, am I seeking his best good? Or I have even more practically done something good for him or her. Is it in my heart to do something good for him or her? And I have these very kind of practical ways of testing my love, and then of saying, now, Lord, what do I do with that? Maybe I have done something good and I'm just thankful. Maybe I realize in my heart there's a reticence to do something good, and I realize there's a lack of love somewhere. So I want to give practical definitions to these things in those terms. But for those of us who like to study, these won't be the richest theological definitions. Pardon me on that. So rich and poor, let's start with that. This is a very profound teaching in the Bible. And the way I want to define rich today is just having more than you need for the day. So it's very practical. In other words, I come to the end of the day and I've had dinner and I have enough in my house for breakfast tomorrow, and there's a positive balance in the bank. That's it. So you just have more than you need for that day. Many of us have more than we need for a week or a month. Classic teaching, Christian teaching on wealth is to try and have 3 months of money set aside. I won't comment on that now, but that's the idea. So likewise, poor would be the opposite of that, and that is to say, I'm starting my day, and I'm not quite sure if where I'm going to get dinner, or if I'm going to have a be warm tonight. You don't have to worry about that today, but in the winter, when you be exposed. And will I have the basic elements? And this passage, by the way, talks about what those basic elements are. We'll get to that verse. So that's kind of a working definition of poor. Now, in our country, most of us are not poor in this sense. But having been in India now, you see that really exists. Many places in the world, India is just one of them. And it's a very, very sad thing. But now, rich and poor can also mean spiritually rich and poor. And I will kind of go back and forth between the two things as we talk. But what I want to say about spiritually rich and spiritually poor is that there is a spiritual analogy to this. That if I'm spiritually rich, God may be speaking to me, and I may be rejoicing in my fellowship with God or other believers. I may be gaining insight that brings joy to my heart. I may be living a life where I feel affection and love for others. There's a spiritual richness in my life, in my experience. And so I have in my heart things to share with others, to bless others. Whereas I may go through periods of spiritual poverty. This is different from not being blessed by God. I'm talking about the experience of spiritual riches in our lives. We read about this in Deuteronomy, the very end of the book, where we read that times come where we pray and God does not hear. Actually, Deuteronomy is a bad place to go because it's talking about blessing and curses. But we read about it in Psalm 22. The beginning of Psalm 22, I call out to God and he's not hearing me. Now, of course, that's a prophetic psalm, and it speaks of Jesus. And when Jesus called out to the Father didn't hear him. But it wasn't because Jesus personally had sinned. We have times where, even though we're in the will of God, we call out and God, it feels as if God's not hearing us. That's how we experience. That's how we feel about it. Right? We have a need, an immediate need in our life, and we're praying about it, and the time is coming. There's a deadline, and there's no answer. So sometimes that's even just an emotional need. We say, you know what, it's been sad for a long time. I need something to lift me up today, and the day continues to unfold without anything that's uplifting. So we can experience richness and poverty in both natural and spiritual ways. Now, I want to say that to be rich or poor, in and of itself, is not good or bad. God chooses the seasons in which we're rich and chooses the seasons in which we're poor. He also chooses who among us may live more of a life in the rich phase and more of a life in the poor phase. I'm not talking about natural things, mainly. All of us can learn to be spiritually rich. That's God's purpose. That's kind of the purpose of this whole talk, is how we become spiritually rich, a true rich, richness, a good richness in our lives. But God has seasons in our lives, and Paul talks about this very, very clearly in Philippians chapter 4. And then he says, I know how to deal with both seasons. I know how to abound, meaning having a lot, and I know how to be abased. And so part of the secret of the Christian life and maturing in moving from things that are false and evil in our lives to being true and good in our lives is to understand that God moves us up and down the richness and the poorness in a sovereign way for our good, and that there's a way for the rich to be true and good and a way for the poor to be true and good, or anywhere you are along that spectrum. Okay. And then the other two words there, true good, false evil, again, simple definitions. In this passage in particular, Paul will speak about that. This, I'll repeat some of these things, that what's true is the things that accord with the teachings of Jesus. Now, that's not a full or profound definition of truth. For purposes of this talk, that's a very helpful one. But likewise, things that are false contradict the teaching of Jesus and of the apostles who bring those teachings forward. And that's all. I won't say more about good or evil right now. Let's go to the passage now and read it. We won't read the whole chapter, and I will skip around a little bit. Let's go to verse 3, and I'm reading it in a New Living Translation because the flow of thought is a little clearer, and it's true to the original text. Some people may contradict our teaching, right? But these are the wholesome teachings of the Lord Jesus Christ. These teachings promote a godly life. Okay, so here now he's talking about what's true, or what's good for you, what brings benefit or blessing into your life. That's how we would use the word true. Whereas evil brings harm to your life, or to the lives of others. So that attention to the teachings of Jesus and the teachings of the apostles as they bring it in the New Testament promotes a godly life or godliness. Now, godliness is another term I want to define here. There's a lot of terms in this passage. And godliness is at its root is the worship of Jesus. It's true worship in our lives. Now, we all worship something, whether you are a secularist, an atheist, they would have trouble saying that, but it's true. All men worship something, and some are naive about it because they don't even know they worship something. But by nature, we are worshipers. We assign value to things that are bigger and better than us. So maybe our, in a secular sense, it may be our intellect, or we may even call it science. For those of us who are spiritually minded, it would be God, or there are many religions in the world we may assign worth to other things, to idols. We were just hearing from John and Sarah about this. Idol worship is a very true, active, and consuming reality for many people in the world. But here, what Paul is saying is, listen, God has spoken to us, first through in Hebrews, first through the prophets, now in these later days through his Son, the teachings of the Son. The teachings of Jesus are important. And they have implications. If we embrace them, we become godly, true worshipers of God. Our heart is set in the right direction through the practical application of the teaching in our lives. If we if we resist the teaching of the Son or contradict it, there's implications. And that goes on. Let's go down to verse 4. Anyone who teaches something different is arrogant and lacks understanding. Such a person has an unhealthy desire to quibble over the meaning of words. And this stirs up arguments, ending in jealousy, division, slander, and evil suspicions. I mean, that's a difficult list. I'm not going to dwell on it in detail. But particularly, I want to bring to your mind this issue of division and of quibbling. One of the things that needs to happen in the body of Jesus Christ, if there's to be good riches among us, is that we will learn not to quibble. There's room to disagree and consider. But when you begin to fight about things and cause division, there's a spirit there that's not the spirit of Jesus Christ. Okay. Notice this also, though, verse 5, continuing in the same vein, these people, the ones who fight, the ones who deny the teaching or contradict or argue about the teaching of Jesus, their minds are corrupt. They have turned their backs on the truth. See, so when we begin to forget about the teachings of Jesus or not dwell or apply them in our lives, we begin to forsake the truth. It's a profound thing. But then notice this. This gets us to riches now. To them, a show of godliness is just a way to become wealthy. I really like that. It's very heavy in my mind. Because I wouldn't tie that in at this point. I wouldn't say, well, some people are fighting about things, and you think this word means this, or that idea means that, or this passage means this, and we have to do this, no, we have to do that, and there's this infighting. I said, well, you know, brothers need to learn to dwell in unity. I go, let me look at Psalm 133. Let me look at Psalm 127. Let me look at how the apostles got together on difficult issues in the book of Acts and so on. But Paul, one of the things Paul's saying here is that one of the motives behind that kind of quibbling, one of the realities of forsaking the teaching of Jesus, is that what begins to drive your life is the desire to be wealthy. And even to the point where you'll begin to look godly if it's going to help you be wealthy. Now you say, well, that doesn't apply too much in the United States. Well, maybe more than we think. Maybe more than we think. You know, we went through a period of time in history where a lot of Christian leaders came down because of misusing money. You know, they own private jets. So I know someone who's learning to do airplane repair. She's finishing her degree in Embry Riddle. She's working on private jets that cost $40 to $60 million. It was not like buying a car for $10,000. These are expensive things. That came from money that was given to that ministry by people like you and me. And so I just want to say that this drive to wealth, this craving after wealth, is a very, very major issue. And it comes out of quibbling, arguing, and beginning to disregard the teachings of the Lord. Here's one of the ways to have false riches up there, and that is to crave wealth. Now, I was going to put all these words up here, but it would get too busy. But if you want to connect rich and false and evil, think of this word craving. We'll see more of this later. Yet, verse 6, now this is the other side of it, yet true godliness, the worship of Jesus with contentment, is itself great wealth. In other words, if I am viewing this question, what is it to have a godly life? What is it to embrace the teachings of the Lord? And of those who speak to me about the Lord's teachings, they instruct me in that. And I embrace that, and I say, you know, that's turning my heart towards the Lord and towards the truth. I'm becoming a worshiper of Jesus, to be content with that. And not say, well, I need something more than that. Now you say, well, I need some basic things for my needs. Yes, we'll get to that. It's not desire to have your needs met that moves you towards ungodliness. It's desire for wealth, for riches, that causes that. And so to connect rich and true and good, we could use this word contentment. It is a very profound and wonderful word that we should learn to be content in this life. That does not mean, then, that riches will not increase or decrease, but that we should learn in the midst of that to be content. Verse verse 7 and 8 develops a little further. After all, we brought nothing into this world, and we can't take anything with us when we leave it. Right, that's absolutely true. Except, he's speaking about physical things here. We can, as someone once said, so use riches of this world to bring blessings into the world, so as to bring blessings for us in the future in the heavenly realms. We'll get to that in a minute. So you take blessings with you. You take faith with you, but you don't take gold with you. Then Paul says here, so verse 8, so if we have enough food and clothing, let us be content. Now, as I go through this, I'm saying always when we make statements about things, like, you know, if you are learn to be content, you can hold riches in true, with true steadiness without it corrupting your life. So then the question becomes, well, how do I know I'm content? How do I evaluate God? Just like I can ask myself, what is it? Am I rich or not rich? How do I decide that? Or if I decide I'm loving someone, how do I evaluate that? So here, Paul talks to us about how we can decide if we're content. And that's this. If we have food and clothing, we can be content. Now, yes?
You said before about meeting our needs, then. It's probably an obvious thought from here, but my needs meant I need my car payment. What's my payment on? Ferrari?
Right.
Or a Kia? I need my house payment on my 1,500 square foot house or my 15,000 square foot house.
Right.
This is clothing, food, it all fits in there. So,
I'll comment a little on it. That's a very good thought. I don't know how much it'll get developed, but
My aunt had a little rhyme next to the toilet paper holder. And it said, all a man needs for 8 hours a day is 1 yard, or in English, in German, 1 meter by 2 meters. That's all he needs. 8 hours out of the day. And, wow, okay, third of your life, all you need is 1 meter by 2 meters.
Yeah. Eric.
Thinking more about what you're talking about, being content, I guess that Jesus and his disciples were zealous to save more souls, and that's not content. So there's somehow that content is, we see like the conflict between the idea of being ambitious and being content, and somehow you must be able to do both.
Yes, no, that's true. And remember that Paul says this to Timothy. He says, be urgent in and out of season. That's that same idea. Be urgent about what it is. Yeah, Claudia?
Contentment is increasing.
Right. Yeah, that's another way to look at it. Being content does not mean you're complacent. It doesn't mean I don't care about certain things. But the idea is that we can be content, particularly with our possessions. And that's what Paul is saying here by way of a test of contentment. Is that if we have food and clothing, with these we can be content. So one simple test for us is when I sit to eat a meal. This has been very challenging to me. I'll tell you a little bit more about it, my own testimony here. Or when I lie down to rest at night, or I put on my coat in the winter to go outside, am I thankful and can I enjoy that thing? Do I put the coat on, go out in the cold, and say, this is a miserable coat, I'm never warm, I'm always unhappy out here in this cold weather in New York, why am I living in New York? Or do I say, you know, thank you for this coat, Lord, and it's helping to keep me warm, and then maybe it wears out, but then I look to God to make provision for me. But I can enjoy the blessings I have, I can sit and I can eat. This is more challenging for me in India, to sit and, you know, it's time to eat, and you don't really have to look at the menu. It's rice and dal. It's rice and dal. And the next meal, it's rice and dal. And you sit and you eat the rice and dal. But can I be thankful for that? And can I enjoy it in some measure? Can I enjoy it? I'm not saying I'm going to enjoy it as much as an ice cream sundae. I'm not saying that. That's okay. But can I enjoy it at all? And so this is a wonderful test in our lives. And if we are rich and going through a period of time where God is giving us more abundantly, are we enjoying those things? If there's one thing I see over the years, because I've met a number of people who are significantly wealthy. I've heard of somebody recently, his net income was like $500,000 a year. That would be a burden. What are you going to do with that money? You'd be responsible about it. It's so much money. But really, he seemed unhappy and restless. Which means, says to me, I mean, I don't know him well, says to me, he must have a hard time enjoying the basic blessings in his life. Maybe he sits to dinner, there's a banquet for the food, and enjoy it. You know, if he has a house, that's probably more than 1,500 square feet. But when he walks in the door, he doesn't say, this is lovely, I'm thankful for it. I'm thankful for what I have here, and I can share it with others. This contentedness. Contentedness ties riches to being true and good. Now, let's go on now a little bit more. Maybe I'll say a little more about verse 10, 9 and 10. But people who long to be rich fall into temptation. Here, there's another long list here. And are trapped by many foolish and harmful desires that plunge them into ruin. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And some people, craving money, have wandered from the true faith and pierced themselves with many sorrows. So I've already said this too. What ties riches to false and evil is a craving for it, as opposed to a contentedness with it. And it's important for us to be able to begin to shape the difference of what that looks like in our minds. And Paul goes on to say that if that craving continues, and we seek to get riches out of a craving for it, that comes out of falsehood. And it pierces our hearts, many pangs, that we turn from the faith, and it is the basis for many evils. So then he goes on, I just want to read verse 11, and we're going to go further down. But you, Timothy, are a man of God, so run from all these evil things. Or really, in this particular case, the way we're looking at the passage, really from this one evil thing, the craving for riches, not the having of riches, the management of riches. Now let's go down, and we're just going to skip a couple of verses. Let's go to verse 17, and we'll kind of finish with this section. Teach those who are rich in this world not to be proud and not to trust in their money, which is so unreliable. Their trust should be in God, who richly gives us all we need for enjoyment. There's a couple of important things in there. So let's say I am rich, because by the definition I gave you, and this is kind of purposeful, most of us are rich. You know, as a matter of fact, I'll probably say, if anyone here doesn't have dinner tonight or breakfast tomorrow morning, please speak to me or Bruce or Ryan, and we'll get you breakfast tomorrow. I mean, there's not a poverty among us in that sense, okay? But now, if we are rich, one of the things that we do, besides being content with it, that help us to stay on the left side of this slide? Well, the first thing here is not to be proud about it, right? He says that, teach those who are rich in this world not to be proud about their money. And you know, if you want to look at an example of pride and wealth, an example, look at which one? Oh, so it's Nebuchadnezzar is the one that came to my mind. Well, I love that little passage. I love it. I mean, it's just very vivid to me where he gets out and he's walking around Babylon and he says, "Is this not Babylon which I have created from the might of my glory?" I think he says. And my greatness, or something like that. And then God makes him eat grass. It just is so striking. And people do that. And I can do that. And when I look around and I am being thankful for the things God has given me, whether it's, you know, not this time of year so much because it's been dry, but there's the beauty of the lawn or the trees or the flowers or whatever it is that you enjoy or you know, you, again, you sit at your table, you're thankful for your table and the meal that's on your table. But your thought must not be, I have this because of me. I did this. I worked for this. I'm not saying you didn't work for it. But you can work and there can be emptiness. There are people who work and work and work and work and they have nothing because they're being denied what's theirs. It's God who gives you the power to get wealth. Can you read that in
Deuteronomy?
Deuteronomy. Yeah, thank you. In Deuteronomy. And so we should acknowledge that. In our contentedness with riches, we should acknowledge this comes from God. What's more, he goes on to say not to trust in them. So that not only in the present do I acknowledge that things come from God, but when I look down the road and I say, well, now, how will I make that car payment next month or in a year? Or how will I manage when I no longer work and don't have an income or so on? As we look ahead, that we must, if we are recognizing that what we have is from God, then we begin to teach ourselves under the rooting of the Spirit to look to God for the things that we need in the future. I mean, this is a common teaching. We all would agree with this. But I'm talking about how it's emerging in our lives. And I have to say this is exceedingly challenging for me because I grew up, as many of us have, with a strong Protestant work ethic. Work, work, work. It's good to work. There's blessings in work. In all toil, there's profit, it says in Proverbs. This is a very, very good thing. But that does not mean that I trust in the fruit of the labor of my hands. What happens when I get old and I can't work anymore? What happens if I get hurt and I can't work anymore? You know, there are all sorts of things that limit me. And even if I work and work and work and work, sudden loss can come to me. There's no guarantee my house could burn down. Right? Somebody could hack an account somewhere and my money's gone. These things have happened. Okay? So, I learn what it is to live my life with the thought that things come from God. And I learned to trust him. I learned to wait upon him and enjoy fellowship with him as I receive things from him and as I learn to be content with him. Then notice that Paul says at the end of this verse, dear, trust should be in God who richly gives us all we need for our enjoyment. See, that's very profound. It gets back to what I was saying earlier. To tie riches to what's true and good is to learn contentment. Well, one of the ways that I learn contentment is to enjoy the things that God has given me. If I receive something from God and I despise it and say, oh, that's no good. That's not enjoying it. That's a foolish thing. That if you feel that way about something that you think you shouldn't have it, give it away. Why be burdened by it? So, verse 18, we're coming to the end here now. Tell them to use their money to do good. That's a real simple phrase. Good to go back to and think about again and again. Do I use my money to do good? But notice this, and I alluded to this earlier. They should be rich in good works, right? The good that we're doing with our money, and generous to those in need. So this is one other word that ties rich and true and good. And that's the word generous. Likewise, on the other side of that, although the word's not specifically used, if I am miserly or greedy, you can use more than one word, it ties richness to falsehood and to evil. One of the worst ways to remain rich is to hoard your riches. It's much better. Nature does not work that way. Nature works with things coming in and out. That would be like to say, I have a river. I love this river. I'm going to save the river, I'll build a dam. Can you save a river by building a dam? I haven't seen anybody do that. You can cause a flood building a dam. You can make a pond with a dam. You'll never stop the flowing of the river. And if you do stop the flowing of the river, then the river's gone. You don't have it anymore. And that's how God wants us to be. Open, giving, and then receiving and giving. And receiving and giving. And I must say, I'm working very hard on this. Recently, God challenged me that to do something, to give something away. And it was a challenge to me. There's been a couple of times in my life where this has happened, where it's off my schedule. Now, I have a schedule to give because if I didn't, I probably wouldn't give anything. I'm just not a spontaneous giver. So, and if you're not, then have a schedule to give, if you need to do that. But there are times where God will break into your life and say, you need to do this now. And you don't want to turn around. If you really think you're hearing the voice of God, don't turn around and say, no, Lord, we didn't plan it this way. You didn't plan it that way. God did. So you listen to what God has to say. But it was very helpful to me afterwards, including I just spoke about it this morning. And I can say this over the years. It's really true. The things I've given away, I've not missed. It's kind of hard for me. Let me just give you another picture, a story about generosity. I'm going to finish soon here. And it was actually a story that came out of my family. It was my great-grandfather. So he came from Italy and was a very successful businessman in the city. He imported fruit, sold it. He made a lot of money. As I understand it, this is like third hand. Like some of this I got from my mother, who tends to stretch facts a little bit. So still, I think he definitely did very, very well. They had money. And so from time to time, his wife, who I knew much better, my great-grandmother, she lived quite a bit longer. She's very dear and was kind to us, great-grandchildren. Spoke only Italian, so she didn't say too much that I understood. But she would say to my grandfather, so-and-so needs something, so-and-so needs something, and they would put money away. But apparently he kept a book of it. And so they would give the money away. There was some expectation that money would be paid back. But after a period of time, if nothing happened, they would just write in the book, so be it. And at the end of his life, somebody, I don't know if this is really true or not, this is a story, they looked through that book, and he had given away over $1 million. That's a lot of money in that day. So that would be like us giving away $5 or $10 million. It's a lot of money. I know most of us couldn't even do that, but he did well. And so that's a story of generosity, but he wasn't poor at the end of his life, because it went out, but God blessed him, it kept coming in. Verse 19, by doing this, by these generous deeds, they will be storing up their treasure as a good foundation for the future so they may experience true life. So this treasure being stored up is not the money you're giving away or the treasure you're giving away. It's a different kind of treasure. It's true treasure. It's spiritual treasure. Those are the treasures you send on ahead of you to heaven, because it's a foundation for the future. Future in this life, but also a future in heaven. It's God uses the natural things in this life to teach us generosity so that we can learn also to be generous with spiritual things and share the good news with other people. Okay, let me just read the last two verses. I won't say much about it. We'll finish with that. Timothy, guard what God has entrusted to you. Avoid godless, foolish discussions with those who oppose you with their so-called knowledge. That is to say, attention to the teachings of Jesus. Some people have wandered from their faith by following such foolishness. May God's grace be with you all. Okay, I will stop with that. I just want to encourage us to have this thought. Lord, teach me not to crave after money. Teach us to be content with what I have. And teach me to be generous. Any final comments on this? Okay, we'll open to testimonies.